This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So if you're wondering what new ways surfing the internet might compromise your privacy, you've come to the right place. Our guest, Julia Angwin, recently led a team of reporters from the Wall Street Journal who discovered that nearly all of the most commonly visited websites are using sophisticated software to track our movements through the web so they can sell the information they get about us. In many cases, the sites actually install tracking software on our home computers without our knowledge. One of the fastest-growing businesses on the internet, Angwin writes, is the business of spying on internet users. The Journal reporters found that even their own newspaper's website is in on the consumer surveillance game. Julia Angwin is senior technology editor of the Wall Street Journal and author of the book Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. She spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Julia Angwin, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd begin with the 26-year-old woman from Tennessee who appears in your story and who has discovered, I assume through your reporting, that her computer has software that's gathered a lot of information about her. What kind of information was being harvested without her knowing?
So what we found that the company tracking Ashley Hayes Beatty knew was that all of her favorite movies, her age, her hometown, and that she liked quizzes and entertainment news.
Right. And this information was being gathered how?
So there were two parts to the information gathering. The first part was she was given an ID number, which was stored on her computer in something called a cookie. And a cookie is something that is just a text file on your computer, really just gives you an ID. And when you visit a website, oftentimes these cookies are installed without you knowing it. So she had an ID number in her cookie. Separately, when she went to some websites, they had a different kind of technology called a beacon, which is another invisible kind of tracker that runs some software while you're on a page and tries to assess what you're doing on that page. So in her case, this beacon actually was seeing her activities around movies in particular. So she had listed her favorite movies on a website, and it saw that she was typing those in and capture that data and put it in her profile, which is stored back at some mothership where there's a little drawer that has her ID number, and inside the drawer there's a file, and the file says these are her favorite movies, and every time they find out new information about her, they add more to the file.
Okay, but the information that was doing all this was not something that she asked for or that came installed on her computer when she bought it, right?
No. So what's happening is that there are tons of companies like the one who was following Ashley that are out there in the business of gathering information about people while they browse the internet. So this company named Lodomy had a relationship with some of the websites that she was browsing on, and those websites basically allowed Lodomy to install this monitoring software on her computer.
I guess what's surprising to a lot of people is that when you go onto the internet, this little piece of information gathering software comes the other way. We think of us as connecting to the internet, but when we connect to some of these sites, this little information gathering software slithers back into our computer, embeds itself there, and then begins spying on us. Is that too strong a word?
Yeah, I mean, I think spying is not necessarily too strong a word, although I think surveillance is probably slightly more accurate. The thing is that the advertising industry online has evolved to really rely on a lot of these surveillance or monitoring techniques. And most people that we have heard from since writing these stories did not know what was going on. So when you go to a website, you're not thinking about the fact that they might have relationships with all these different types of monitoring firms, and that those firms are installing things that are invisible to you on your computer. Now, there are some very tech-savvy people who are diligent about removing cookies and trying to block all this type of monitoring software. But the vast majority of people that we've heard from didn't know about it.
Right. So the average computer user, the person that does some shopping online, that enjoys surfing the web, how many different little pieces of information gathering software might they have on their computer without their knowledge?
Well, definitely hundreds, right? because we did a survey of the top 50 U.S. websites to see how many they installed on our test computer. And collectively, they installed more than 3,000 pieces of tracking technology. So that would imply that by just browsing the top 50 websites, you would get 3,000 things on your computer.
That's a lot.
Yes. It's a lot.
Maybe you should explain just a little bit about how you and your team at the Journal did this kind of research. I assume you did not go to the public relations departments of these websites and ask them.
No, I mean, we did talk to the public relations departments of these websites after we did our survey. But what we did was we hired a researcher who specialized in doing this type of data collection. He had a clean computer and he cleared it of all tracking devices that had already been installed, made sure that, you know, he wasn't browsing and collecting things from previous visits. Then he went to visit each of these sites and saw what kind of technology was installed on his computer when after that visit. And he tried to visit 20 pages on each site. And during this, there are many different types of tracking technology out there. We focused on the collecting data on three of the most prevalent types. So cookies, which are text files that are stored on your computer. Most of them give you sort of a unique ID number. We looked at flash cookies, which are also similar to cookies, but they're stored by your flash video player. So when you watch YouTube videos or other flash animations online, that program could be installing a flash cookie. And we also looked at beacons, which are basically invisible bits of software code that are installed or that run live while you're on a web page.
One of the most surprising things that I read in one of your stories was that a number of the websites that you looked at that were clearly installing information gathering software on people's computers didn't even know they were doing it. How does that happen?
Yeah, it's amazing. So we were surprised about that. We thought that it would be the case that most websites would know that they had a relationship with these third-party companies that are installing tracking devices. But in fact, we found that tracking devices, the way they're distributed is that they can often be distributed by a third party. So for instance, the tracking company might place one of its little monitoring devices within an ad. And then when that ad appears on the website page, the device is installed. So the website doesn't actually know what's being installed on its users' computers. We also found that tracking devices sometimes contained other tracking devices in them. So there is this what's known as piggybacking. And so they might know about the relationship with one, but they don't know about the one that was contained in the other inside of it.
Wow. Let's put some names with these. You looked at the nation's top 50 websites, found that they were installing collectively around 3,000 pieces of information tracking software in people's computers. What are some of these websites?
Well, so we looked at all the big websites. I mean, the top 50 list includes, you know, Google and YouTube and Facebook, all the sites that you normally think of as the top websites. What we found was the sites that were installing the most, the one site that installed the most was dictionary.com, actually. A visit to dictionary.com resulted in 234 trackers being installed on our test computer. And only 11 of those were installed by dictionary.com. So this might be a good moment to just mention that some tracking devices are completely innocuous. A cookie or some kind of tracker is what remembers your password. And so if you ask a website to remember your login, that would be stored on a cookie. So there are tracking devices that are useful to you as a web browser. And those tend to be the ones installed by the website that you actually have a relationship, not the ones that you've never heard of before that are sort of secretly lurking behind the scenes. And so on dictionary.com, most of the trackers, the vast majority, more than 200 of the 234, were installed by companies that the person visiting the site probably had never heard of.
Hmm. So if those of us who are out there on the web using it as normal users do have dozens, maybe hundreds of these pieces of information tracking software that are gathering information about us without our knowledge, where does it go, and what are the people who are getting it do with it?
Basically, there's an ecosystem of hundreds of online advertising companies who are in the business of tracking web surfers. And for many years, most of them had their own network of tracking, and then they would take that data and try to sell it directly to an advertiser. What's happened in the past year and a half is that now there are data markets where these tracking companies now try to sell your data on an exchange, which is really like a real-time Wall Street sort of automated trading floor where the data about your behavior online is being sold at auction.
Wow. Now, this I'm trying to picture, and you did write in the piece that one of these companies that trades this stuff sells 50 million pieces of information a day for as little as a tenth of a penny a piece. Explain this to me. What kind of information do they get about me, and who's going to want to buy it that day for a fraction of a penny?
So if you do something that has high value online, for instance, searching for a car, basically searching for something to purchase, that makes you very interesting to an advertiser. And so the information would be something like ID number so-and-so is looking for a car. And the company that captures that information may post it for sale immediately, almost instantaneously, on one of these trading floors. So the one that we wrote about was called BlueKai. And for instance, they have a relationship with eBay. So the moment I've done this many times, I went and searched for something on eBay. Then I looked in the BlueKai registry, which they are kind enough to show you what data they're selling about you. You can see almost immediately that it pops up and says you're in market for whatever it is that you just searched for on eBay. Then there are a bunch of advertisers lined up at their door who have already placed bids to automatically buy up anybody who's in market for that item. And so instantaneously, they can show you an ad wherever you next land on the web for whatever product it was you were just looking for.
Wow. So if I look for some new dining room furniture, some third-party tracker gets that information, puts this up on an exchange and says, anybody want to find people looking for dining room furniture? Somebody who's selling dining room furniture says, yeah, I'll buy 200 of them for X price. They get that information and then can find a way to get to me.
Yeah, and you may have had this experience. I mean, I certainly have. There was a pair of shoes that I was looking at online, and then those particular shoes actually followed me around on every website I went to for a month. They had clearly bought me, and maybe this is because I'm tuned into it because I'm writing about it, but you may have noticed that various items following you around online.
Now, explain this. What do you mean these shoes are following you around?
They really were. They really were following me around. I looked at them, and then I put them in my basket because for me, which is rather sad, but for me, this is what constitutes fun, is putting things in my basket that I'm not going to buy. It's just like it's like window shopping, right? So I put them in my basket thinking if I was really rich, I would buy these shoes. But I don't feel rich right now, so I'm not going to. But they were able to follow me around, and a good number of the websites I went to in the next month had those exact shoes in an ad looking at me. And this particular type of tracking and monitoring is called retargeting. And it's considered one of the most productive types of targeting because I actually ended up buying the shoes because they kept following me for so long that I finally caved in.
Oh, that is creepy.
Yeah, and you know what? It's not that creepy with shoes, to be honest with you. I didn't mind so much, but I think what's creepy about it is that they target on things like, are you bipolar? So imagine that you've been searching for information about bipolar disease, and then every ad is targeting you as bipolar. That seems creepy. That's where you get into the question about health data and financial data. Some of these things maybe should be protected categories.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about these, I guess for lack of a better word, middlemen. I mean, these people who promote these tracking devices and then gather this data and then slice it and dice it and price it and put it up on these exchanges and sell it in huge batches to whoever is offering to meet the price. Who are these people? I mean, are these 26-year-olds in sneakers? Are they big companies?
They're mostly 26-year-olds in sneakers, and they might have a PhD in math or statistics. So, I mean, these are quants, right? They used to, you know, some of them used to work on Wall Street. Some of them might have been responsible for blowing up the financial markets. But basically, the ad business it's no longer Mad Men. You don't have men sitting there drinking martinis, at least not with this online business. This is really a math exercise. People are building algorithms that can automatically slice and dice this data and build these profiles without any human sort of really looking at them. And it's a very, it's like a real time, you know, everything happens in milliseconds, and it's all about, you know, how big is the computer you can get to do these calculations.
Now, let's clarify a couple of things here. When this information is gathered about you, are they getting your name or just some long serial number that associated with your computer?
No, they are generally not getting your name. In fact, that's the industry says, we never get your name. Occasionally, you might register at a website, and that website has your name. But in general, these third-party monitoring tracking devices don't know your name, even if the website you're visiting does. So that's one thing to point out, is they don't know your name. They know your behavior. One thing, though, that the industry is doing more and more often is they're using your behavior to make inferences about who they think you are. So they may buy data from some offline brokers estimating your income, your age, your hometown, et cetera. And so they can make some pretty educated guesses about who you are, but they are not attempting to find out your name.
Okay. So they build a kind of a demographic profile of you, in effect.
Yeah, it's exactly right. They put you in some sort of bucket. And some of these buckets have funny names. We talked about them in one of the stories that, you know, they categorize Americans into all these different segments like white picket fences or bohemian mix or, you know, bohemian urban dwellers, you know, so you might be in some bucket.
But I guess, you know, to the layman who hears this, you wonder, well, okay, but if they're tracking all this stuff, if they're getting into my computer without me knowing it, and if they can follow my keystrokes, what prevents them from getting the password to my online bank account or looking at the Quicken files with all my family financial information?
Yeah, look, I think that the keystroke monitoring that we wrote about is pretty avant-garde. That was, you know, the websites that involved do know that they're allowing that particular kind of monitoring, and they only allow it on certain pages where fairly innocuous things are happening, like talking about movies that you like. We haven't seen any evidence of somebody deliberately allowing keystroke monitoring on a page where you would enter any sort of sensitive information. And I think you would be entering into the realm of fraud at that point, not what this is, which is a legitimate industry based around tracking your movements in an anonymous way. Now, you might want to argue with whether this is legitimate, what they're doing, but I don't think anyone in it is actively engaged in fraud that I know of. But it does raise the question, because the technology is out there, that it could get into, you know, bad hands.
I want to clarify one thing. Beacons are a particular kind of software that gets installed on people's computers to gather information. Does that track keystrokes?
So beacons are basically a kind of software that runs in the background while you're on a page live. It doesn't install onto your computer. And they can do a variety of things, including log your keystrokes if the website that has installed that beacon allows that to happen. It's fairly rare that anyone is allowing a keystroke capture. The instance that we talked about, though, with the movies and the woman whose favorite movies were known by a tracking company, that company had a relationship with a website that allowed them to capture her typing in her favorite movies. But that's fairly unusual and probably the cutting edge of use of beacons.
Hmm. So what distinguishes the beacon from cookies is that they're not on your computer, they're on the website and they're following what you're doing?
Yeah, the beacon is the running on the page in the background, but a cookie is something that is stored on your hard drive and doesn't sort of actively monitor. It only knows what page you're on, but it's not attempting to see what you're doing on that page.
This has to raise some privacy concerns. Are there court cases on this, on what's permissible and what isn't?
Well, when cookies were first introduced and started to be used for advertising, there were a few cases, and the courts ruled that it was a fair use of cookies to have advertisers kind of quietly install them in the background of a website. And the legal thinking around that had to do with telephone law. And basically, the argument was it was sort of like the website was a caller and you were and they were talking to you on the phone and they were sort of secretly allowing a friend to listen in on another line. And so there is a legal grounding for this type of monitoring. What's happening now is that this kind of monitoring has exploded, right? There's more trackers than anyone ever envisioned back then a decade ago. And so a lot of people are rethinking some of these laws. There's a couple bills pending in Congress, and the Federal Trade Commission is rethinking its guidelines on privacy and planning to issue new guidelines by the end of the year.
What are some of the issues that you think should concern us the most?
One issue is the question of anonymity. I think it's totally fair to say that these tracking companies don't know your name. But my feeling is if they know everything else about you, does it matter that they don't know your name, right? Because it feels intrusive to have somebody know so much about you, particularly when we do so much online. I mean, for at least for me, I do everything online. So when I look at my record of my browsing history or I look at what web pages I've looked at, it really seems to be like a record of my thoughts. Every time I have a thought, it seems I actually take an action online and Google it. So it does build up these incredibly rich dossiers. So I think one question is knowing your name the right definition of anonymity? Right now, that is considered anonymous. If they don't know your name, they're sort of not covered by laws that regulate personally identifiable information. And that's what the FTC is considering, is whether the definition of personal information should be expanded beyond just name and social security address, a number, and a few other things. Another thing that it raises is sensitive information. So if you're looking at gay websites and then you're sort of labeled as gay in some database somewhere and that follows you around and you're sold on some exchange as gay and you just may not want that to happen. So I feel that there are some categories of information being collected that we as a society might not want to be collected. Our political affiliation, our diseases, our income levels, and you know, many other things. Or, you know, what if you're feeling suicidal and you spend a bunch of time looking at suicide pages? Do you want that sort of in some database somewhere?
In addition to which, they can get it wrong, right? I mean, you might be researching something that you're not necessarily interested in, and they can be misled.
Exactly. And then you're going to see that all the time. And people are going to make judgments about you based on that. You know, and we have laws about your credit score. Your credit score affects a lot of things in your financial life. And because it's so important and affects so many things, there are laws that say you get to see the components of your credit score and have the ability to correct them. Now, it's not so easy to do that, as anyone who's tried knows, but at least you have the legal right to that. And I think that we might reach a time where this kind of tracking information, your electronic dossier, might determine so much about your life that you would want the ability to see it and correct it. And there are websites that are beginning to offer that. So the industry has acknowledged that, but it doesn't go far enough, in my opinion.
And how would they correct it? I mean, you can look at your own profile and amend it?
Yeah, so some websites, some of the bigger companies in this tracking field, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, this trading exchange, BlueKai, that I mentioned, Lotame, the company that monitored that woman's movie preferences, they have places you can go on their web pages, assuming you've ever heard of them, and know to do this, and they will tell you what they know about you. So you might go in and it says, oh, we think you're, you know, 15 years old and you love gambling and you love sports. And if we're wrong, you can fix this or you can try to remove all the information. Most of them will allow you to remove all the information from the profiles.
You know, a lot of computers are shared. And then, of course, if a profile is built of you around you based on the computer you use, you're not going to keep that computer forever. Isn't this information, I mean, both transitory and in some ways misleading? Because you could have four or five people using a computer at home.
Yes, it's true. The information is both transitory and misleading. So what most of the data exchanges or most of the people buying this information pay a lot for recency because they feel that any actions you took a month ago might not really reflect who you are. But a lot of this market is actually really instantaneous so that you could take an action on one web page and then see something different on the next web page. And so that's how they attempt to get around the problems that you're talking about, which are that shared computers and the fact that some of it might be wrong.
Which browsers or websites stood out as protecting privacy better than others?
So it's worth calling out Wikipedia because they, on principle, don't allow any type of tracking technology on their website. So they were the only one we found with none. Facebook, actually, and a few other sites had very few. I think Facebook is a good example of a company that has plenty of information about you and really no interest in sharing that information. So there's no reason for them to allow someone else in to spy on you since, you know, their big value is that they know so much about everybody. So some of the websites were better, but on average, most websites installed 64 different types of tracking technology. So the average is still pretty high. In terms of web browsers, none of them are great at blocking this type of monitoring. We had a big story about Microsoft and the battle at Microsoft internally about whether they could improve the privacy of their web browser software. And ultimately, they decided not to improve it in large part because of the advertising side of their business. And that's the sad truth is that the two of the biggest browser makers, Microsoft and Google, are very heavily in the advertising business, which is essentially a business of tracking. So they don't have very little incentive to improve the ability of the web browser to block this type of software. So the best way to get around this kind of tracking is you have to install some additional software into your web browser that would block it.
Yeah, let's just pause over Microsoft for a moment here because Microsoft Explorer, I guess, is by far the most widely used web browser. And there was this debate about whether they would change, I guess, the default settings, right, so as to exclude this kind of information gathering. Was that the debate essentially?
Yeah. I mean, the engineers at Microsoft had a very innovative idea, which was to attempt to block tracking devices from companies that didn't appear to be the one that you were transacting with. So meaning if it's not the website that you're actually visiting and it's some other company installing some tracking device on your web browser, the default was going to be, no, I don't want that. And unfortunately, their view was overruled by the advertising side of the company.
Right. And just kind of help us understand that. Why would the advertising side of Microsoft want users of the Internet Explorer to have all these third-party information tracking devices installed or pieces of software on their users' computers?
Well, Microsoft is not just a web browser maker. It's also it runs a very big online advertising firm. And that firm was among the biggest trackers that we found in our database. So they were the second largest installer of tracking software among the 50 websites we surveyed after Google. So they are in the business of tracking users and compiling profiles of users and then selling those to advertisers. So the idea that this web browser would have blocked that would undermine the entire business model, not just of their ad business, but really of the entire online advertising industry. So it was a very threatening move that these engineers at Microsoft were proposing.
Nobody has more information about us than Google. Are they marketing what they know about us?
Yeah, so Google is Google seems to know everything about me for sure, and I think that that's probably true for most people. Google has been extremely cautious in the past about using what it knows about people. in part because their business is built on trust. One reason we share so much with Google is that we trust them not to abuse it. But the developments in the online ad industry have been moving so fast, right? So tracking has become so pervasive and the markets for data have sprung up out of nowhere that Google is now actually being forced, Google is now moving more in the direction of tracking than it ever has before. In the early days, you know, the founders of Google were opposed even to the idea of using cookies. And now they're among the biggest trackers, and they are considering all sorts of moves into what really is the bleeding edge of this industry.
So just to be clear, I mean, one of the things that we know Google does now, and it's a great revenue source for them, is that if we go online looking for running shoes and do a search, it'll pop up ads from people who are selling running shoes, even running shoes near where we live. But what we're talking about is them keeping – aggregating all this data they get from all of the times we've used their search engine to go to all kinds of websites, taking all that data, aggregating it, and selling it to others. They're not doing that yet, but they may?
Well, the thing is that right now, when you go to Google and do a search, you've told them what you're interested in, right? So when they serve up an ad to you based on that interest, it's not as creepy as when the shoes that I was looking at started following me around from website to website. But Google, in addition to having a search advertising business, has a company called DoubleClick that they bought 2 years ago. And that company really is in the places ads across many websites all across the internet. And so Google is really looking at how do they improve that business. So not so much about their search business, but how can they use all the data they have about online behavior across all their properties to help improve their ability to serve up these ads across all the other websites that DoubleClick and their other ad properties serve. And that's where you get into the issue of, well, could they use some of the data they have in one bucket, maybe their search data or the information they have about what you're interested in from Gmail, to improve the targeting abilities of their other advertising business?
Is anybody in the government thinking about this stuff?
Yeah, I think that there are some bills in Congress that aim to tackle these issues, and the Federal Trade Commission has been holding a series of roundtable discussions this year about privacy and particularly about this tracking business. But it's a really hard thing to regulate. This is an industry that's moving at light speed. There are new types of tracking technology every day. There are new issues about new platforms. So we've been talking about tracking online, but mobile is a whole different world, right? That's where they know your location. And, you know, the cookies on your mobile phone, the tracking devices, you can't even see them. At least on your computer, you can go into the back room sort of your computer and see what's being installed there. Most cell phones don't even allow you to see what kind of data is being tracked. So I think the problem for regulators is how do you get your arms around sort of this ever-expanding pool of technology, and as soon as you regulate some, another one's going to pop up somewhere else.
Let's talk about things consumers can do themselves if they want to. Can you block this information gathering software from making its way onto your computer?
Yeah, you can do a couple things. You can try to play around with your browser, web browser settings to block these type of cookies. But none of the web browsers have made it particularly easy. Although Apple Safari, by default, blocks third-party cookies, which is a large part of the tracking, but not all of it. Then you could also install additional software onto your computer that would block this tracking. So there's one in particular that we recommended called Abine, A-B-I-N-E, which will block all the types of tracking that we looked at in our database, which is cookies, flash cookies, and beacons. And also you can go to the websites of all these tracking companies and ask them not to track you, which is kind of absurd because you'd have to know who they are. There is a list of all of them on the ad industry's webpage, and you can opt out of all of them at the same time. But one thing to know about opting out of tracking is that they actually put a tracker on your computer saying, don't track me. So you're opting into being tracked for not being tracked.
Well, and I should also say that the series that you and your team did in the Wall Street Journal has a really terrific web section in which a lot of this is explained and a lot of information about individual browsers and websites is contained. So you can go onto the Wall Street Journal website in the non-charging part of it, although as you note in your piece, when you go onto the Wall Street Journal's website, it also installs tracking software, right?
Yes, it does. We checked ourselves to make sure that we were being fair. And the Wall Street Journal installed just slightly less than the average number of trackers. We built a big online database of all the trackers we found on each website. And this was actually for us at the Journal a new thing. We haven't been building big comprehensive online databases. So we wanted people to really have a chance to look at their favorite websites, see what we found there, and explore some of the information about how their data might be used.
Is there anything else that should worry us or reassure us on this subject?
Well, one thing that worries me about this emerging market for data is who's buying it. Right now, it's primarily advertisers. But there's nothing to stop a health insurance company from going in and buying data about all the people who are browsing sites that are talking about certain diseases and then trying to figure out whether they can exclude them from their policies. Or an insurance company looking at people who are browsing sites for like super fast car driving and then trying to make their premiums go up. And we haven't seen this yet, but the fact that this data is available raises that possibility, and that worries me.
You know, one of the fascinating and maybe troubling things to contemplate about this is if these companies are collecting this information, building a profile about us that they assume is accurate but may not be, that's then sold to advertisers as well as, websites, which then tailor what they present to us on the internet based on who they think we are. I mean, is there a concern that we're, getting either a reflection of our own interests and losing kind of the diversity of the web, or that they're getting it wrong?
I mean, yes, this is a concern. I mean, I don't know if you or our listeners know this, but already Google has started using what it thinks it knows about you to give you different search results. So you and I would see different results based on where Google thinks we're located and the cookie on our computer, the ID number, and the information they have about our previous searches. And they are trying to provide us a better service, but at the same time, they could be wrong about what we want to see. And this is true across the web. So as more websites are using this type of data to customize their experience, so a news site customizing it based on the fact that they think you're a sports fan and putting sports news first, or we wrote about a credit card company that's showing credit card offers based on who they think you are, that you're starting to see an internet that looks like yourself. That you're standing in a hall of mirrors and all you see around you is this reflected version of yourself that might not be true, actually, but is sort of the dossier that's been built up about you electronically. To me, that changes the entire experience of the internet and makes it a place that feels very narrow. And the beauty of the internet is sort of the breadth and width of our experience there, that you can find anything you want and that you have this feeling that you're anonymous and that you can sort of peer into other people's lives.
Well, Julia Angwin, it's been an education. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Julia Angwin spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. She's senior technology editor at the Wall Street Journal. Our website has links to her articles about consumer surveillance on the internet, and we have links to websites that will help you opt out of being tracked by companies that want to gather information about you while you're on the internet. Our website is freshair.npr.org. Saxophonist and composer Steve Coleman has been a major force in jazz since the 1980s, a nurturer of young musicians, and a composer whose diverse influences include serial procedures derived from modern European composers and the counterpunch rhythms of boxer Floyd Mayweather Jr. Coleman's first album in several years with his band Five Elements has been released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead likes it. We'll be right back.
As a composer, Steve Coleman has been heavily influenced by James Brown's funk. You wouldn't mistake Coleman's band Five Elements for the JBs, but like the Godfather of Soul, he goes in for fast, jittery beats. On Coleman's new album, Harvesting Semblances and Affinities, Five Elements is powered by a rhythm duo who sync up in a few bands, bassist Thomas Morgan and drum phenom Tyshawn Sorey. Jen Hsu on vocals. Steve Coleman is always connected with singers. Coming up in the 1980s, he worked with the veteran Abby Lincoln and fellow newcomer Cassandra Wilson. Hsu's role is slippery here. She's not quite out front and not quite fully aligned with the sextet's three horns. Her main feature is the one non-original tune, Coleman's setting of a choral work by Danish composer Per Nurgard. He's an influence on Coleman's own arcane ways of developing material, like dipping into the so-called undertone series, which is basically the natural overtone series turned upside down. Don't ask me to explain it. If Steve Coleman's music sounds a little chilly sometimes, it's because he's more interested in compositional logics than setting a mood. That's okay. There's room for all kinds of approaches. That adapted choral music prompts us to see Coleman as a composer of contemporary art songs. His pieces often revolve around looping phrases or recurring patterns that overlap or seep into each other. It's the West African drum choir principle. Wheels within wheels can keep rolling indefinitely. Because Steve Coleman generates his own musical rules, he's had to school musicians in his organizing principles, and his band includes younger players open and smart enough to keep up with the concepts. His new album was actually recorded in 2006, and the musicians involved have already gone on to apply his lessons elsewhere. Drummer Tyshawn Sorey, trombonist Tim Albright, and the fine trumpeter Jonathan Finlayson all play in Steve Lehman's octet with its own complex procedures. Coleman has also influenced a host of younger saxophone players, so he doesn't just make music that's brainy and funky. He helps shape players who develop things still further on their own. That's really giving something back to the music.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Harvesting Semblances and Affinities, the new CD by Steve Coleman and Five Elements on the Pi label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.